Hello, curious minds, and welcome back to another episode of Curious Katio, where we dive deep into ideas that pique my curiosity, are of interest to me. And this year and this season, it's all about books I've read and stories that I was curious about and what I learned from them and the impact. I'm your host, Katio, and today we're going to take a really interesting journey through human history with an author called Yuval Noah Harari, and his best-selling book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. And so if you've ever wondered about how we as Homo sapiens became the dominant species on the planet, or if you've ever been curious about the surprising twists and turns in our journey from wandering nomads to city dwellers, this is really the book for you. And what I'm going to talk about today, we'll uncover, you know, five key findings from the book that really stood out to me, that surprised me, and might make you rethink a little bit about what it means to be a human. So first, let's talk about the author. So he is an Israeli historian, professor at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And he isn't just a historian, he's really a storyteller who uses his knowledge of history and biology and philosophy to try to tell a story that's compelling and thought-provoking and makes you think. And when he wrote the book Sapiens, he wanted to challenge the way we think about our past and in turn think about our future. He really wanted readers to understand that the history of humanity isn't just a series of random events, but more like this complicated, interwoven tapestry with all these little threads and choices and accidents and forces that happened to really get us to where we are right now. And in the interviews, when people are talking to him about the book, he often emphasizes that it isn't just a history book. It's really a book about the future. And what he believes is that by understanding where we come from, we can better navigate the challenges that are coming our way. And so let's talk about some of these key findings that have really made this book something that has become a universal bestseller. So the first one is around this idea of the cognitive revolution and the power of shared myths. It's one of the most surprising and central ideas in the book is this idea of the cognitive revolution, is what he calls it. So he argues that about 70,000 years ago, Homo sapiens experienced this huge leap in our brains that really set us apart from other species. And this leap wasn't about individual intelligence, but it was really rather about our creativity and our ability to create these and believe in these shared myths and stories. And so what he writes is, you know, quote, "There are no gods in the universe, no nation, no money, no human rights, no laws, and no justice outside of the common imagination of human beings." And so that statement can be startling and profound, right? You know, he suggests that what truly differentiates us from other animals is our ability to believe things that exist purely in our imagination, things like religion, nations, and corporations. So I want to pause here for a minute. This does not mean that, like, these beliefs are wrong. It's just something that's really unique to humans. And no other species on the planet has brought forth items like religion, like nations, or even like a corporation. And we're the only ones that do this. And there's no other group in their herd or communities or, you know, bunch of lions on the Serengeti. They're not forming religions or corporations or nations. And so this idea of a myth is not necessarily around it doesn't exist. It's the idea that we've created something from nothing, or our brains were able to envision something beyond the current that was in front of us. And our brains were able to reshape that thinking into something that was organized and allowed groups of people to organize around it. And so these shared myths, that he calls them, have really allowed large groups of humans to cooperate in a way that no other species could. You know, while other animals can work together based on, like, immediate needs, humans can collaborate on a massive scale because we believe in these shared stories and these shared experiences. And this cognitive revolution really set the stage for everything that followed, from the creation of complex societies to even things like the development of money and governments. think about what documents are important in this country, in the US, that this belief and this structure that we believed into that then formed things from like the Declaration of Independence to the Constitution to how we think about core foundational beliefs today. And those were because a series of people thought up that idea, right? It's something that we created and came up with, and we imagined what it could be like and then put pen to paper. And that's the idea, is there was this huge shift in humans and the brain and the ability to go, I want something that looks like this, or I want to believe this, and then I'm going to create things around it that could make that real. That was really the first big human leap that moved us from where we were, you know, pre 70,000 years ago. The next big movement, the next key finding, was this idea of the agricultural revolution. And what he refers to it as is the biggest fraud in history. So he is not a fan of it. And it was interesting. I had never thought about it, which is sad to say. But when I was reading this book, it was a really interesting and pivotal moment for me to think about how, you know, certain decisions could impact long term all these things that you might not envision downstream. So a key moment in our history was this agricultural revolution. And around 12,000 years ago, humans began to domesticate plants and animals. And what we did is we transitioned from a lifestyle of hunting and gathering to one of farming and settlement. And at first glance, it seems like super positive, right? After all, it led to cities, it led to writing, it led to civilization as we know it. But what the author argues in a surprising perspective, calling the agricultural revolution history's biggest fraud, he really argues that while farming allowed for larger populations and surplus food, which is what you got, right? You farmed and then you hopefully sold some of it. It also led to a host of problems, including things like social hierarchies, labor exploitation, and the spread of disease. And so for most individuals, life became harder and less healthy compared to the nomadic ancestors that they had. Once you had a farm and a house, you had to provide. And you could only likely grow a few things and have a few animals. So you had to figure out how to have dinner that wasn't like potatoes every day because your body needed variety, which you got when you were a nomad. You wandered around and there were animals that you killed and there were plants that you ate and you went to different areas and you exposed your body to different things. I'm not saying there weren't risks with that system, but it was just different. And so when you had to accommodate the changes in weather and wars, but you were stuck in one place, it made you more vulnerable than when you were nomadic and could move, you know, wherever you needed to. If there was trouble over here, you could move somewhere else. And so what he argues is that the home and land and putting yourself in one place almost became more of a prison than a palace. And so he points out that it was really the biggest fraud. Wheat domesticated us rather than the other way around, is what he quotes in the book. In other words, instead of humans controlling wheat, wheat controlled us, dictating our lives, our diets, when we worked, when we got up. You know, we were at the mercy of that food source. And so this shift really locked humans into a cycle of toil and, you know, work that we experience today. And so what he asks is, you know, what was the true cost of that? Now, I will be the first to tell you that if I had to be a nomad and wander around every night and find my own food and all of that, I would probably not live very long. You know, some of us have thrived in this domesticated world, but we've also set up all this infrastructure around it to give us the variety of foods that we need or, you know, different ways to work. And so the ability to live in an agricultural system was very different. And his, you know, understanding is what is the cost of that? What has that done to us and how we think and where we spend our time and how healthy we are? You know, there's a lot of questions around this idea of what being an agricultural system did to us. The third key finding is around this unification of humankind. And he talks a lot about empires, religion, trade, these big, huge concepts and ideas that really allowed humans to come together in groups that were very different. And so as humans settled and formed these really large communities, another significant transition occurred, the unification of us. You know, he talks about three forces that have unified humanity: empires, religion, and trade. So those are the three things that bring big groups together. With empires, you know, despite how brutal they are and were, they've played a huge role in bringing together diverse groups of people under a common political system. You know, similar to universal religions like Christianity or Islam or Buddhism, they've created this shared belief system that can often transcend local cultures. And trade has also been a really powerful unifying force. It connects regions. It fosters the exchange of goods and ideas. And so think about that. If we didn't have empires or religion or trade, what would it look like? You know, I think of the U.S. a lot in terms of, like, we don't like to call ourselves an empire, but we do have a complex political system that has, you know, a national lens. It has 50 states. Within those states, it has cities or smaller towns or municipalities. There's all of these different things that have to come together to bring these diverse groups of people and thought and experiences into a common political system. You know, if you think about religions, there are religions that are all over the world that are practiced under a shared belief, but different lenses as to how they do it. And then trade is really this idea of expanding beyond your horizons. And in doing that, you don't just learn about somebody else from what you get from them and what you sell to them, but you start to learn about their culture. And so he writes, you know, his quote is, "History teaches us that what's good for an empire is not necessarily good for its subjects." And we see that. That observation reminds us that while these forces have united humanity, they've also led to exploitation and conflict and inequality. They're not always good. And so people need to form structures to control their thinking and beliefs and actions of a large group, but they also need to understand within that structure what they believe and what fits. And if it's not fitting, what might be good for the overall system might not be good for what's local. And that's often why in the U.S. people talk about this idea of a system that you want the majority of what controls your daily life to come as close to home as possible, or as close to your local government as possible. You know, and it's that idea of, yeah, you need to have big things that tie us together, but there's also this element of, you know, what really controls your life, and does it make sense to have it be more local or more national? And so, you know, when I think about this, I think about the Roman Empire, right? Like, how large was that? How many cultures did that cross? How many nations? How many belief structures? And how did they control something like that together? And it was through this empire mentality of, you know, control and wars and shared beliefs that was able to bring a system that large together. The fourth key thing he talks about then is the scientific revolution. And this is really about two key concepts, which is knowledge and power. And so if you fast forward, you know, the last 500 years, we arrive at the scientific revolution, so about 500 years ago. And it's a period that he argues has had more profound impact on humanity than any previous revolution that we've had. You know, the scientific revolution introduced a new way of thinking, which is probably why it changed things more than anything. It's one based on the belief that we can improve our understanding of the world through observation, experimentation, and evidence. It's taking things that you believe and figuring out a structure that allows you to determine what's true, or what's true as you know it today. So he highlights that the scientific revolution was closely linked with, you know, European imperialism. And his quote is, "The feedback loop between science, empire, and capital has arguably been history's chief engine for the past 500 years. You know, this revolution not only expanded our knowledge, but also fueled the rise of capitalism and the exploitation of natural and human resources on a global scale. It's also brought about great things because of that capitalist view and that scientific view and the, you know, expansion that we have seen. The idea that knowledge is power, you know, became the driving force behind European conquests, and it led to the domination of much of the world and the profound changes in global societies that we still experience today. You know, think about today and the control, power, and money that the communication tools, we'll put that in quotes, that we have, you know, that we use, that we see, where you're trying to figure out, is what I'm seeing real? You know, what do I believe is true? This idea of, like, well, it's true to me, you know, so what is this absolute truth versus belief in truth, and what it does to people's communities and groups. So what has communication done relative to knowledge and power? And in the past, this communication was really controlled through who could read or who could not read, what could be printed, what could be spoken about. And there were laws and rules and constraints. And today, you know, it's more neutral. The system of communication is just there as a platform, and everyone can communicate anything and everything. And that has really changed the dynamic between information, reality, and truth. And so that has been a big shift for us to determine as we move forward, how has the scientific process reshaped how we think about the world and how we think about us in that world. And then the last is this idea of the age of humankind. So he talks about this current era in which humans have become the dominant force shaping the planet, which I think we would all agree is true. Our impact on the environment, the climate, even the genetic code of living organisms is unprecedented and probably not something that the folks 500 or 600 years ago would have even been able to concept. But what he warns is that when you have such control, you have a lot of responsibility that comes with that. And I think this is where he starts to talk in the book about if you understand where we are and how we got here, it might shape what you do next. And so he really poses this as a critical question, and I'll quote it, "Is there anything more dangerous than dissatisfied and irresponsible gods who don't know what they want?" And what that quote made me think about, first of all, I don't think humans are gods, but it made me think about the Greek and Roman gods, right? They were these individuals, almost like soap opera stars more than gods, in that they, you know, would get dangerous and they would get dissatisfied and they'd get upset with somebody and then they would create chaos that would come out of that. And I think what this question really underscores is the potential risks of our current trajectory, where we're just barreling forward with technology advancements that could lead to extraordinary achievements, but it could also have catastrophic consequences. You know, I think about every marketing conference I've been to in the last 2 years has talked about AI. And have we really played that out? Do we really know what that's going to look like? It could be amazing, the achievements we're able to create with AI. It might have consequences that the Terminator movie keeps trying to tell us over and over and over again that might come true. We just don't know. And so it's this idea of, are you being responsible? If you are the dominant force on the planet and you can drive what happens, are you taking that responsibility seriously? And so he talks about how we have to consider the ethical implications of what we do, especially as we develop technologies that could fundamentally alter what it means to be human. So what makes Sapiens a bestseller? You know, to me, it wasn't just the insights and the narrative. It was the author's ability to weave together this idea of history and science and philosophy and culture into a story that was really interesting to read. There were several points in the book where I paused and had to go, I never even thought about that. You know, you just kind of live your life and you're a human and you're in the world as it is today. And how often do you think about, you know, the reason I live in a house and have a yard is because of decisions that were made tens of thousands of years ago. And so he challenges that assumption and this idea that, you know, things are uncomfortable. Sometimes truth is uncomfortable. And he just wants you to think intentionally about it. And in interviews, he's mentioned that one of his goals in writing the book was to make people question their beliefs about the past and the present. And he hopes that by understanding our history, that we can make better decisions about our future. A future that is increasingly not something that we will just wander into, but a future that is increasingly something that we are going to create by our actions. So when I, you know, finished the book, it was this weird lens that I had into our species as humans, and what responsibility we have moving forward and what role we might play in what that future looks like, both good and potentially catastrophic. So thank you for joining me on this deep dive into the book Sapiens. I hope you found these insights interesting and thought-provoking. I really enjoyed this book. And if you haven't read it yet, I would highly recommend it. And if you like this episode and you did read the book, I'd love to know if there was something that stood out to you, made you question something or made you curious about something. Until next time, keep thinking about those questions, keep thinking about those things that you're curious about, and I can't wait to see what book we tackle next.